In December 1998, I went to the White House with the band. And fuck me, if President Clinton wasn't being impeached that day. The Senate broke. They called him up and said, Mr. President, you're going to be impeached. We're on our way over. So all the trucks were there from the news media, as you can only imagine. We were all at the Secret Service shop in the basement. There's a firing range down there, and a major tunnel with a train that's propelled through a pneumatic tube. You strap yourself in, and it goes, pachoo, to some DUM, Deep Underground Military Facility. America's full of DUMs. But enough about our managers. We're getting walked around, given little gifts, Secret Service golf balls. Clinton's press secretary comes down and goes, Stephen, do me a favor, can you come upstairs, please? I said, that's fine with me, but we're playing tonight. What time do you need to be there? 6, and the gig is 3 hours away. No problem, we'll get you there. They took us upstairs to a waiting room to hang out till Bill Clinton could come meet us. And where do you think they put us? The Situation Room. I'm sitting in the president's chair, looking around at all the monitors. We met with Bill, briefly. He was kind of busy that day, you think? Then we were escorted quietly out of the White House. We were walked out to a police escort, off to Quantico, FBI headquarters, to stroll down a street with full-on machine guns. They let me shoot dummies at a practice range there that's mocked up to look like a city block. Animatronic figures pop out at you as you walk around. The head of a terrorist leans out and you shoot at it. Then an animatronic little girl leans out with her doll. Oops. I Don't Want to Miss a Thing was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song. It was the theme song for Armageddon, which was especially sweet since Liv was one of the stars of the movie. I was going to perform it at the Academy Awards. I peeked through the curtain and looked down, and there's Eric Clapton and Sting and Madonna and all the people from my era sitting in the front row. Just before the curtain opened, my keyboard player kicked the cord out, and it took out my ears so I couldn't hear the mix. When the performance starts, I'm supposed to be up front with the guy playing the cello for the opening line of the song. They went, 60 seconds. But wait, I said, I can't hear anything. Is that mic on? I walked back to my production man and told him, don't let them open the fucking curtain yet. I have no ears. Do not open. They did it anyway. And so the song started, and I was 20 feet from the cello player. I wasn't about to run up to the front of the stage. Everyone in the place would have laughed. Ah, ha, ha, look at Steven. He lost his mark. I'm a little more professional than that. I walked up real slowly. But by the time I got to the cello player, probably 30 feet away, the first verse was gone. I blew the first verse. Live TV at the Oscars. Oh, man. We'd got our number one hit record, been at the Grammys, and still had half a Grammy left. Sung at the Academy Awards. So I had to go through a few rough periods, but it was all worth it. Aerosmith was at full tilt. I was happily married to Teresa with two beautiful children, Chelsea and Tive, plus my Liv and Mia. Life was good, and I had nothing to worry about. Or so I thought. Chapter 14. Holy Smoke, Quest for the Grand Pashmina and the Big Chill of 20 Summers. I found myself making snorting sounds. Snuffling like an armadillo in search of fire ants. My nasal passages were completely clogged. No, not from coke. Fuck no, I stopped in 1980. I stopped smoking. I stopped everything. Well, for X number of years anyway. To this day, no damage to the nasal passages. No, the snuffling was from the way I slept. I used to sleep on my back, and the fog juice. My sinuses had mutated, become an alien life form. 30 years of breathing in the damn oil-based fog juice. That's the stage smoke they use to enhance the beams of light. The smoke makes everything look bigger and more dramatic. It's holy smoke. You see more colors. This is how it works. The guy doing the lights hits a foot switch that activates the smoke machine behind the drum riser, and up comes this apocalyptic fog juice. It's blowing out on stage, and I'm inhaling it, taking a deep breath to launch into the song. It's like being a fucking monkey in a lab experiment. A demented researcher is saying, All right, let's fill this room full of smoke. Get the little chimp to sing at the top of his lungs for 20 years, and then we'll run some tests. If I get sick, I've got to cancel. And when Aerosmith cancels a show, it's $1 million. I tell you, the worst time in my life is when I'm taking a shower or sitting in my room. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we've got a gig that night, and I go, fuck, I can't do it. My voice is gone from laryngitis. Either I have a high raspy whine or a deep bullfroggy honk, but either way, I can't sing. I hate that. I lose it. Knowing that there's 20,000 people on their way to the concert. They're high and happy, thinking they're going to get laid tonight, and now they're going to find out over the radio that the concert is off, and they're all going to go, aw, shit. I feel for them. Now, someone like Axl Rose, on the other hand, will handcuff himself to the toilet at the hotel and have people wait 4 hours for him to show. Why does he do it? That's just how Axl is. He'll say, the marbles were thrown and the color red didn't show up, so I can't get there tonight. Some astrology theosophical omen like that, and he won't move. We have to take out $8 million in insurance in case anything goes wrong with Steven the singing monkey. Anything could happen to anyone else in the band, unless they break a leg, and the show would go on. So once again, Steven's the designated patient. Rather than the band spending insurance money if I get sick, I take a shot of a type of cortisone to reduce the sinus inflammation. It's called the Medrol dose pack, and it shrinks them. After years of inhaling fog juice, I had a serious case of sinusitis. Gunk dripped down my throat like a slow-running faucet. They had to operate. Roto-rooted my sinuses, stuffed them with cotton. I'm lying in bed that night after the operation, and I wake up because I'm going, like I'm swallowing in my sleep, going, what is that warm mucus-like gunk? I reach over and turn the light on, and oh my God, blood is pouring out of my nose, dripping like that thin stream of water out of the faucet when you're trying to fill the little hole in your water gun. Except it wasn't a faucet, it was my nose, and it wasn't water, it was blood. I freaked out. I said to my wife, Teresa, quick. She went in the other room and got a wad of toilet paper. After a minute, it was soaked. More toilet paper. Soaked. With blood. When a human sees that much blood, it's, call an ambulance. Ambulance came, took me to the hospital. I'm lying there. Nobody's doing anything. You guys, I'm bleeding to death here. That hospital didn't have the capabilities to do anything about my bleeding, so they stuffed me up with cotton and rushed me down to Mass General. They cauterized my nose at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the bleeding stopped. 2 hours of hell. Blood all over the place. I had an operation, then everything was fine. My nose is still fine, thank you. No schmutz in my lungs either. Did you hear anything? When I first blew a tire, so to speak, in my throat, people started saying, Steven Tyler has cancer. What I actually had was a broken blood vessel in my throat. When I had throat surgery, the doctor said, no talking for 3 weeks. Now, how was I supposed to do that? I went back to see him and he said, you talked. I got deep with it. I said, what are you talking about, doc? There isn't a soul on this planet who can shut up for a day, never mind 3 weeks. Unless I tape my mouth up, there's no way. We're humans. We're primates. We talk, and talking is my life. People talk in their sleep. They talk to themselves. And personally, I suffer from being vaccinated with a phonograph needle. Steven, another week, he told me. And he did that 3 times. It went on for 5 weeks. It was a fucking nightmare. The way they treat a broken blood vessel in the throat is just astounding. They put a tiny camera down my throat with a laser attached to it. On a computer, they draw a line around the spot with a green laser beam, and then they delete it the way you would a sentence in a word processing program. They tap on the spot, and it gets rid of it. Dr. Zeitels is in there with a green laser, and he's going, gone, 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 gone. The green laser eats the blood under the skin, evaporates it. It's gone. Star Trek. I watched it back on a monitor. It was un-fucking believable. While Dr. Zeitels was working on my throat, I told him, I have an idea. We're playing in Minneapolis. Why don't you fly to the gig with me? Bring your gear. That way you can film me before a show, during Joe's solo, and after the show. You'll get to see what it's like to be me. Flew him out. He did it. All the way, I'm going, Doc, I mean, what if we went public with this? Well, you see, no one's really done this operation on film before. So let's do it. I'm a lead singer. What more dramatic candidate for this operation could you get? We thought about it for 6 or 7 years, and then we simply took the film footage of him zapping the blood vessels with a laser, some performance stuff, and they began to put the sequence together. I thought they should get me singing Dream On. As he was going down my throat, I said, Oh, shit, if you're going to film me singing Dream On while I'm in the chair, I want to caterwaul the chorus. I couldn't do that if he went down my throat, so he went down my nose instead. He put the micro camera in, and I really slammed it out. The footage ended up on National Geographic's The Human Body. When they did the show, you heard me singing in the chair, the doctor talking, and all that stuff. And when I sang that, they could cut to me on stage singing it for real. While I was at MIT, Dr. Zeidels gave me a tour of the lab. They put me in a red jumpsuit and took me down to the lab to see rats growing human ears. What they're doing there is pure science fiction. They paint organic webbing with human skin on it and attach it to the rat. So now it's getting a blood supply. It's absorbing it. It's called osmosis. The whole National Geographic special was interesting because it was about the physics of singing, how your throat functions as a musical instrument, and how that instrument can bend, melt, twist, and wring emotions out of words. Sung words are mutations of written words. You come to a phrase in a song, your brain gets altered. Words behave very strangely when they're fused with music. What is music, anyway? And how does it go from bum-da-bum-bum into a song? When we sing, we convey emotion by raising the pitch. The notes change the form of the words. Tone determines emotion. Praise. Stop. Pay attention. Comfort. A melody with a rising tone keeps a child calm. A minor second is jarring. Music literally touches you. Sound is touch at a distance. It touches your brain. Monotone speech is robotic. In tone languages, words take on meanings from different pitches. In English, we don't depend on tone for meaning, but in Mandarin Chinese, for instance, tone determines the meaning. Depending on the tone you use, Ma can mean mother, hemp, horse, or reproach. The Chinese are very adept at using different pitches to indicate meaning, but perfect pitch is very rare, like having a tuning fork in your brain. Everything has a voice and a key. A car horn is an F. Bells are between D flat and B. 1 person in 10,000 has perfect pitch. Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven all had perfect pitch. I've spent my life listening to singers and realizing which ones could sing really well and are still lousy. It has nothing to do with perfect pitch or music lessons. Thousands of people sing great with well-trained voices. The ones that have character in their voices are rare. Fucked up voices with a ton of character. That's my idea of a great voice. My first album, people were going, Steven, I know that's you singing, but how come it doesn't sound like you? Well, I tell them, I didn't like my angelic voice, so I did it in my fake ghetto voice. It was then I realized that I needed to fuck it up good, like the great ones, like Janis. That rusty, ornery, bar at closing time voice. She could fuck up a song brilliantly. She had a raspy, croaky voice. She was born with a raspy voice. She had vocal chops that no other singer had. She wasn't the perfect American girl. She was skinny, had long fucking thick-ass hair, R. Crumb running out of the pages. You know, Angel Food McSpade? She was her fucking white counterpart. That was Janis. And don't I know that? I've been around people who break into a tremulous vibrato. They've learned that shit. They've spent thousands of dollars to be able to do that fucking vibrato that doesn't belong in any fucking song. There's a few who know how to bend it. Robert Plant would do a little bendy thing at the end of a song, but it was all from feeling. You go to Broadway, and a guy looks up the lights, and he goes, his fucking head goes bobbing back. It's all a learned, conditioned thing. It's dead as a doornail and stale as a stranded whale. With Aerosmith, we do so many different flavors. Game On, Shank After Rolling, Seasons of Wither, Nine Lives, Taste of India, Ain't That a Bitch. We do Down Home Delta Blues, Sleaze Boogie, Anthems, Mandolins, Steel Drum Calypso, Wailing Sirens, Cat and Heat Yelps, Sentimental Ballads, Metal, Beatles Covers, Mooing Killer Whales, and the Shangri-Las. You can't put your finger on what we do because we do a lot of different kinds of music, unlike Metallica, which does only one genre. Have you ever heard a slow Metallica song? Is there one that you could dance to at a prom? If you asked them, they'd go, why would we? You can know all the technical stuff of singing, but it doesn't matter in the end because it's too over the heads of the audience anyway. Once you learn the nuances of music, you've got to take it somewhere else. There comes a point in most great musicians' evolution where they no longer hear all that underpinning. They only know the words that are thrown over the music. Every time that I look in the mirror, you take off from that. You don't know what you're singing or what chord it is. Animals don't have brains like ours and are easily impressed by big fake-outs. If you hold a blanket up to a bear, it'll run away. They tell you, lay down. Yeah, so it eats your ass? No, you should go, arrgh! Jump up and down, scream, grab a blanket, a big branch, because an animal doesn't know the branch isn't you. Long ago, humans found out how to extend their egos. If I build a building, it will be an extension of me. People know it's not you, but in some way, it is you. Just like a song. That's my feathers, my proud plumage. It was March 2001, and I was on a quest for the Grand Pashmina. Otherwise known as how a European tour almost got canceled on account of a 600-pound garden ornament. I was up in Sunapee closing up the house. We had a week before going on to Europe to begin a tour. I was trying to lift a 6-foot black feather lawn ornament made out of wrought iron. There was still permafrost in the ground, and in trying to move the fucker, I pulled both sides of my back out. I couldn't get out of bed without excruciating pain, and the thought was looming in my mind that we might have to cancel. The gear's already on its way over there on a steamship. Just to get out of the bed, I'd have to roll on my side and then get on my hands and knees and then slowly get up. It is the worst pain on earth. The muscles were ruptured. I was under a cloud, just a looming sense of doom reawakening my fear of abandonment, the overwhelming feeling of I know not what. I went over to Europe anyway, to do a tour promotion. There I am in Munich, freaking fucking out. We get to the hotel, and there's the classic promoter's assistant. They're always a hoot. Sometimes you can play them like an old 45. Right before the chorus, you lift off the needle because you know what it's going to be. The thieving, lying voice of the promoter. You try to weasel under the threat of their spiel and get into whatever is actually going on. But on this trip, it wasn't drugs I was after. I was in search of the Grand Pashmina. It's a soft woven cloth made from the underbelly of goats up in the Himalayas. Every night when the stars shine, their fur glistens with tiny sparks of light. I bought one for $600. It was about 3 feet wide and 6 feet long, so it could cover me completely. And when I pulled up on it, it was like Empress Chinchilla, softer than the fold of a clit. And that took my pain away for a minute. And then it all came back horribly, gruesomely. And I finally broke down and said to the promoter's assistant, look, I'm in agony. I can't move. I won't be able to perform. My back is fucking killing me. And she goes, ah, stop right there. She knows about everything in München. Legal, illegal, hookers, drugs, record albums, American-ish food. Ach, ach, gescheiß in eurem Hut, she said. Literally, oh, go shit in your hat. But basically, fuck off. And I said, really? Thank you. But then she took me to this doctor who took care of the Munich football team. Huge guys who play in the games against England's Chelsea Arsenal and all that. I walk in, and there are 6 blondes from hell. German blondes. I went, fuck. In the doctor's office, I'm lying down on the operating table, and I say, doc, are you fucking kidding with these nurses? How do you work with these gorgeous women? He goes, well, you should see my wife. No, but really, what's going on with them? Is this Are you... If you're not careful, I'm going to throw him in the back room in a few minutes. And nein, das ist not so good to do, he says. This is what I got here for you. And he shows me this concoction that he's going to use to take care of my pulled back. I deal with this all the time. In 2 hours, it will be all over. I said, what? Yeah, 2 hours. I just came from America doing the seminar, and I showed them the procedure, but the insurances wouldn't allow it, because we do injections in your backbone. There. He's pointing to the bottom of the spine, on each side of the spine, close to the spine itself. You put a needle in 1/4 inch because the spinal cord's inside the bone. There's a little divot there before it goes to your rib cage, a little bit of meat. I'm a little scared, and I say, can you show me the bottle? All right, read this. So he goes out and takes care of another patient, and 10 minutes later I've read the whole back, and it's a bizarre concoction, a mixture of ground-up liquid rooster comb, shark cartilage, stuff like that, and another chemical, butylpenexopropafene or something. Shark cartilage, rooster, whatever, but that fleshy substance, that's the shit. People swear by shark cartilage here in America. Buto, whatever, had helped me out for a while. It's a supplement for cartilage, for back pain, knee pain, joint pain. Basically, a joint pain supplement. But now, I'm getting the great kahuna of all supplements. The Cockrell Comb Shark Cartilage Butylprofen Shot. I was scared shitless. I was very much in the middle of should I do it or not. And just at that moment, I said, all right, fuck it, do it. He comes in and he gives me a series of 12 shots on either side of the backbone, like L9, L10, whatever. A shot of Novocaine first, then the injections after. Then they brought me into another room that was like a closet with a really soft doctor table and a bottle hanging from the ceiling. What's this? Oh, don't worry. It's amino acids. It helps in healing. Well, that's another thing America doesn't do. A half hour, 45 minutes later, I'm peeing in the bathroom and I notice my back was still a little tight, but it didn't hurt. Back to the hotel room, watched some TV, went to bed, woke up the next morning. Pain, gone. I'm telling you, gone. Back problems seem mild compared to our days of yore. The Aerosmith days of rape and pillage through Europe. I remember one time in the late 70s when we so destroyed a hotel in Germany that Interpol was waiting for us in the next country. We were in Rotterdam and it was, what seems to be the problem, officers? Us? International fugitives? What do you mean? Send lawyers, guns, and money. No back problems among the savage roadies in those days either. Once when we were in Paris, the crew were caught in a traffic jam with a bus full of gear. A Citroën had overheated and was smoking in the middle of Rue Foch or some foggy place, so the roadies just lifted the car up bodily, put it on the sidewalk, and proceeded to the concert site without missing a beat. Of course, in those days, they were superhuman, fortified by chutzpah, lust, and pharmaceuticals. When a doctor came backstage at an Aerosmith concert in those days, they'd say, "Trapper's here." And a handful of the crew guys would go over to him with their teeth taken out quick, and they'd go, oh man, my tooth fell out yesterday. Bloody their mouth up a little and get Oxycontin prescriptions. They're a fucking bunch of carnies, me included. But I'd get the bill, and it would be for $600. What's right down from Russia? Ukraine? No, keep going. Toward England. Yeah, Finland. Hello, Finland. We played Helsinki and a bunch of other provinces around there. In the Eastern Bloc, I'm looking around, it's like girls from hell. High cheekbones, blonde hair, natural blondes. Dirty, but not sewn in and not stripper-like. Real dirty blonde hair with rug to match, and you just wanted to get down and root for taters. These girls were gothic. There's a name for a girl that shaves her puss because she's that sexually active, and it's called Please Will You Marry Me. It's the ones with the tattoo down there, the tramp stamp, the Aerosmith logo with the wings that are really hot to trot, or else that have a tattoo with Chinese characters that you don't know what the fuck it says. Harder? Maybe. If someone did a study of rock stars, perhaps I should create a chair of rock star sexual studies at some university. Have them write papers on the sexuality of Keith Richards, Slash, Mick Jagger, Jimi Hendrix, Janis, the boys that Janis loved, and the girls. You'd find that all these rock types have a certain kind of overzealous DNA, a bug-eyed hairy monster gene that leers out of their mom's pussy the moment they're born. Hey, we grew up on our crumb. We have that headspace. Everyone wants to see other people naked. I just don't want to see my schlong on YouTube. I have a guy, Juan, do my dressing rooms because there is a camera in the wall somewhere waiting till I take my pants off. Fuck yeah. Okay, put on our next CD. Just push play. It's 2001, the new millennium, the new, improved Aerosmith. I'm writing Jaded with Joe. I'm in Joe's basement recording, and I ask him, what are we doing this weekend? Now Joe, because he doesn't get thick into lyrics and write melodies, says, I'm taking a break. My wife and I are going to the movies. And I think, well, shit, Teresa's going to be fucking furious with me because we're not going to the movies. I can't just stop writing lyrics in the middle of a song. I can't sing, hey, Jaded, you got your mother's smile, but you're... and then answer the phone and just resume what I was writing. It's like climbing a rope out of a well. Do you stop halfway to answer your cell phone with your foot? When you're in a train of thought like that, you want to keep going. So I went up to Sunapee with my friend the songwriter, Marty Fredrickson, and left Joe and Billy at home to go to the movies. Then I have to deal with Teresa yelling at me about, if they're taking the weekend off, why don't you? There's a little bit of that sideways anger I have toward Joe and his wife leaking out. But it's just what I have to walk through to get that song out. I'm with Marty Fredrickson. We're out on the lake in a canoe, and we're writing Jaded. Monday, we come back, we start in with the band again, and Joe realizes that I've written the song without him. Marty was staying at his house, and someone in the family read Marty the Riot Act for being a traitor and writing a song when Joe wasn't there. But you know, behaviors can be forgiven, and you gotta forgive them. They were high. Little did I know at the time that Aerosmith's fate depended on that song. According to Donny Einar, if we hadn't come up with that hit, Sony was getting ready to drop us, period. He said those words to me. If you hadn't had that song on Just Push Play, we would have dropped you. That's pretty heavy. Shit. But stop me. I can't write from anger. I'm trying to be the lovely sober Stevie that's glowing. The placenta water is pouring over me. With songwriters, when one of you comes up with a line, a riff, the other guy doesn't go, oh, shit, he's getting all the credit for this. Someone picks a little bit of inflection that you said and says something that you would have never thought of, and that propels you. The song builds. You climb up another rung. You're a man possessed. You can't even stop to wee-wee. Writing Jaded, was it out of anger? When you write a song with somebody, you're evoking the spirits of a moment in time. Flecks of words, tunes, riffs hovering in the air, tripwire, seconds where you sing. When I heard Joe play that riff, I knew where to hang my hat. Hey, jaded, you got your mama's style. But you're yesterday's child to me, so jaded. You think that's where it's at? But is that where it's supposed to be? You're getting it all over me, X-rated. My, baby blue, yeah, I've been thinking about you. My, baby blue, yeah, you're so jaded, and I'm the one that jaded you. Sarinda died on September 7th, 2002. Let a song go out of my heart. When bad things happen, people tend to go, God, it's God. God did everything. There are no coincidences, and everything that happens, happens for a reason. Well, I sure don't think Sarinda should have died from a brain tumor. Was it me? Should I have made my first marriage last, no matter what, till death do us part? Should I have made that work? Well, sad to say, I'm not a good candidate for saving a bad marriage. I could barely keep my head above water myself in those days. Or should I have, when I was in rehab, forced her to go into rehab with me? Your toothbrush is packed and you're leaving tomorrow. That one really haunts me. I told her, I'll send the plane. But Sarinda did not want to go. Who does? I should have gone and gotten her myself. That might have worked, but I don't know. Until people are ready to stop, it doesn't work. And even then, It rarely works. When I found out she had cancer, I tried to help, but it was too little too late. I got my doctors together at Sloan Kettering to check her out, a room at the Gramercy Park Hotel, and Bobby Dabba, such a sad end. So unfair for someone who had to put up with me for too much of her life. In 2006, I was at the clinic at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, he's Deepak Chopra's brother, said to me in his "The Monkey Knoweth Not the Taste of Ginger" voice, "It is time, Stephen. Go in for your hepatitis C treatment now. Neither time nor the Ganges waits for critical matters such as this. You know what I'm telling you. If this bad business is happening all the time to you, only worse will come of it." I'd known I had Hep C for years, because a few years before this, the doctor had told me, "You know, Stephen, you've got something weird in your blood." I would do blood tests 3 times a year and see my viral levels. I was asymptomatic, meaning no symptoms, so who gives a shit? People who have Hep C are usually lethargic and tired, but I never get sick on tour because on the road my subconscious functions on another level from that of other humans. It's as if when I'm about to get sick, the flu or whatever, it goes, "Oh shit, you're going on stage? I'm fucking out of here." I had Hep C for 4 years and it never stopped me. "Now, Stephen," Dr. Chopra said, "I am very pleased your subconscious is so obliging and you are asymptomatic and so on and so forth, but veritably, it is time." "Time? For what, Dr. Chopra?" "Time the band took a year off." I went, "Oh, shit." But wait, it gets worse. I was staying at my brother-in-law Mark DiRico's house because at the time we were in the process of fixing my house, rebuilding Taj's and Chelsea's rooms and a lot of other stuff. Teresa would be over at the site during the day and occasionally so would I. The main part of the house was cordoned off with tarps. Mark is not only my brother-in-law, but when he's not building houses in the New England area, he's my partner in crime in DiRico Motorcycles. But later for that. He's been building houses for the last 30 years, some of the finest homes in all of New England, the kind of houses that will still be standing 200 years from now, double insulation, commercial standard heating and plumbing, all that stuff. Mark had a troop of 12 guys doing major reconstruction, when one of them caught Teresa's eye. So the band took the year off. We're rebuilding the house, and there's these roofers and sheetrockers from hell with no shirts and pierced nipples, and they're climbing all over the house like red ants fixing it up. Chelsea and Teresa would be over there checking on the progress. But little did I think that they were looking at these construction workers like that. Teresa had told me that there were some hotties over there, and Chelsea was buzzing around. She was 14, 15, but stupidly, it didn't occur to me that my wife had her eye on one of the guys, too. And that he was making eyes at her, just as I do on the road with hotties in the front row. I said to Sanjeev Chopra, "You know what? Send a couple of nurses out and show me how to do it." So they came out with a month's supply of needles, which come in a box. There's 4 in a box, they look like darts, and they're filled with interferon, and you keep them in the refrigerator. The ampoules are loaded, you pinch the fat on your side, which everyone calls love handles, but I don't have, stick in the needle and go pht, into your skin. Pht, Monday, pht, Tuesday, pht, Wednesday. My joints ached. I tossed and turned. I couldn't sleep. The nurses gave me a month's supply of interferon and a bottle of ribavirin pills. That's the system called Pegasus for treating Hep C. I'd been put on interferon 10 years ago, and my viral levels actually went up, and that's not good. But I was reassured that that had frequently happened in the past, but that the FDA had done new tests and released it as effective, mixed with the pills. They claimed this new regimen would kick Hep C's ass 70-80% of the time. Dr. Chopra told me to do it for 9 months. I did it for a year. I walked the distance. But the interferon not only kicks Hep C's ass, it kicks your ass. You take 3 pills in the morning and 2 at night. Your muscles ache, you can't get out of bed, you hurt all over, Your hair starts falling out, your fingernails turn yellow, your toes turn orange and purple. You feel like you're dying. And that's what it's meant to do. Trick your body into thinking it's dying. Your immune system goes, oh shit, I've got to get it together and knock this thing out of my system, or we're both going to croak. If there's anything threatening your body, your immune system revs up, kicks ass, and kills it. The Hep C virus lives primarily in the liver, but you can't inject the liver. Whatever you put in there doesn't stay, it gets pissed out. So how else to deal with problems connected with a liver than by putting your whole immune system in jeopardy? Several times in the night, I would have to move over to the other side of the king-size bed because there would be a huge wet spot, and not from the reasons I would have loved. I'd go through 4 t-shirts a night. I'd wake up all clammy and wring them out. Your body sweating, thinking it's dying. I did the whole process for a year, but after the 3rd month I said, fuck this, I can't stand the pain. So I went to the doctor. I told him, I'm not taking anything. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic and proud of it, and I'm not gonna. And Dr. Chopra, in his all-knowing, all-seeing voice, says, well, I don't want you to suffer. At which time, the addict in me responded, all right, doc, give me whatever you got. I'm on half a Vicodin in the morning and half at night. This could be a litmus test for addicts. If you give 5 people Vicodin, 4 will fall asleep and 1 will stay up and clean his room. That would be the addict, and that would be me. So now I need a sleeping pill to get me out of my room. Oh, my addict loves that. So it's the 3rd month into the Hep C treatment, and I'm back on the drugs. My wife decides to leave me. Let another song go out of my heart. I've got both kids in the house. I've been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And on top of it all, the doctors say I'm in a clinical depression. You think? I'm a fucking mess. Who wouldn't be? Oh, God. What next? What the hell? Was there a snaggle-toothed witch somewhere cackling over a Steven Tyler doll made of wax? Where shall I stick this pin next, my pet? In the heart, or better yet, liver, knee, toe, or spleen? For Steven Tyler shall not rise again. Is that my phone beeping or is it my brain? Does the noise in my head bother you? For 5 months, I was a weeping, crying mess living in the other side of my house, sleeping in a room with my son Taj, who at the time was 8. He's worried about what's going to happen to his mom. Mom's going to be fine, I'm telling him. Don't worry, everything's going to be all right, as I hold back the tears. I never cried in front of the kids when it came to me and their mother. I loved her then, as I love her today, and I would never let them think that I didn't. It was the first time the band took a year off in 30 years. They went to Florida, bought cars, and fucked and ate ice cream, and I went through Hep C hell and lost my wife. Alleged friends of mine, people reading some crackpot book, would say to me, Steven, dude, it's your karma, you had it coming. I don't think so. After the Hep C treatment, I was doing half a Vicodin twice a day and all that. I had 12 years sobriety when all that shit hit the fan. And so the Hep C treatment went for a year of that, and then I doubled up on the pills. I took 3 in the morning and 3 at night. I locked myself in my Uncle Ernie's room in the back part of my house and lived there. I was off and running with the drugs. Most people stop the Hep C treatment. They start doing it and they go, fuck this, I can't go to work. Luckily, I didn't have to go to work. Killing the Hep C was my job. I persisted. And now, I'm darn near down with the flu. My toe got sick and my liver too. Oh man, I'm beginning to sound like a Luke the Drifter song. And 10 months, 12 months later, non-detectable in my bloodstream. Done. Ding. Over. I did it. Wife's still gone, but we go back on tour. I was lucky for the diversion, but still brokenhearted. Therese left me for this young guy with pierced nipples who was building our house. Why she did it, I don't know. Everyone's got their reasons. Even Hitler had his reasons. You were gone for 10 years, she told me. It killed me. I may have cheated on her, but I was home every night I wasn't touring. I know all women like to go, huh? Because they think it's funny. In the beginning, it's size isn't everything, sex isn't everything. Bullshit. I found that out a little too late. You have a marriage, you got kids, you bring millions of dollars home. Doesn't make any difference. You had an affair? You cheating, adulterous son of a bitch. And to her, I was that guy. If a woman marries a rock star, doesn't she know that women are constantly throwing themselves at him? And being a man, what is he meant to do? How about if I was married to Pam Anderson? Would I be surprised if last time she visited Kid Rock, they slept together that night? Fuck no. I could be completely wrong here, but she's a sex symbol, and I'd have to understand that. Sex symbols attract sex, and they get off on the interplay. It's the drama of it, and that's how they derive their sense of power. True or false? I've heard this over and over, and I tend to agree. But in the end, I hurt her, and so I regret what I did. We could have worked it out. You'd rather leave me than work through it, I said. Of course, I made the mistake of going to her and telling her I'd had an affair. My friends would say, what'd you tell her for, you goddamn fool? And they'd be fucking right. When I was younger, for guys it was lie till you die. There is no telling a woman, especially if she says to you, just tell me the truth, I won't be mad. But now I was sober and in rehab, they'd said tell the truth will set you free. Supposedly. In August 2008, my daughter Mia had a book out called Creating Myself, how I learned that beauty comes in all shapes, sizes, and packages, including me. She called me up. Daddy, I'm going to be on Good Morning America with Matt Lauer and talk about the book. I just wanted you to know. When I saw her talk about her problems, I was mortified. She was telling the world that she's a cutter, still cuts herself when she's stressed. It really hit me hard because I wasn't there for her when she was growing up. Oprah and everybody watching who gets the big picture is going to go, what a bitch of a father. She must have been crying in the empty house and in a desperate state and turned to cutting herself. And that's what I knew when I read her book. Like father, like daughter. Mia had drug problems as a teenager, drinking, diet pills, but I didn't know about her cutting herself. At one point, I tricked her into going to rehab, saying I was sending her to a spa in California. My heart broke, thinking that I had anything to do with her drug addiction. In the end, I told her about this old AA slogan that I'd heard in the halls where a lot of people vent their woes. A lot of your problems have my name on them, but most of the solutions will have your name on them. Not long after that, I was walking along the beach. I dropped to my knees. I began crying because I realized that I'd gotten sober, but I hadn't done it for my kids or even my own health. I hadn't thought about them when I was using, so why would I have gotten sober for them either? Drugs robbed me of my spirituality and compassion, only later to find I'd lost Liv and Mia as well. I cried when they forgave me for my past behaviors, but I'll be working on it for the rest of my life. What would I say to my children? We may have picked a key, but they are their own song. We don't own them. They only pass through us. As Khalil Gibran says in The Prophet, they don't owe us anything either. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. For their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. In the end, all I could do was write a song for her. Mia. Last year, I told the band we should call our next album 20 Summers. They all went, oh, 20 Summers, man, that's so great. Pause. What the fuck does that mean? Well, I said, you know, that's all you got left. And everybody gasped. People don't like to think about it, but like the Reverend Steven Tyler said, ladies hold the aces, and their lovers call it passion. The men call it pleasure, but to me, it's old-fashioned. Times, they're a-changing. Nothing ever stands still. If I don't stop changing, I'll be right in my will. It's the same old story, never get a second chance, for a dance to the top of the hill. Me running the loop in Sunapee, passing a jogger running the other way. Female voice, hey, I know you. Me, you think? I walk off the set of Good Morning America after I've done another phony intimate interview. I go into a bathroom and some little shit has followed me in there. Christ, I'm pissing at the urinal. Hey, man! And right there, it cuts off the flow. I mean, how am I expected to pee when the guy standing next to me is internally hemorrhaging? His fucking urine flow ain't going nowhere either. My nerves have somehow pinched it off and nothing's come out of me, so I head off to a toilet stall to finish the job. I close the door and it's like, ah, a shiver goes down my backbone because finally no one's staring at me. No one's trying to get at me. I'm alone in my wild lonesome in that room. And for that one blissful moment, I think to myself, finally, you're in peace. Then here it comes from over the top of the stall, a woman's voice. Can I have your autograph? I turn whilst still in midstream and piss all over her pumps. And for one wild moment and while we're stewing in my own juices, I realize life's a pisser when you're a-peeing. The aloneness. It's a world in and of itself. Bitchy female fan. Boo-hoo. Bitchy female fan's best friend. Let him finish. This is a riot. It's the yang of yin, if I may put it like that. It's the other side of frivolous, kinetic, sparkling energy. It's a deep void, the silent play square. In that anechoic chamber of my own brain, anything I want to come out can, because it's not being interrupted by other ignorant motherfuckers, otherwise known as the precious children of God. And the media, my darling, bitchy female fan, Jesus, he's not going to play that tired old number two. Bitchy female fan's best friend. Shut up. They all have to bitch about the press while at night they pray on bended knee to the whore of Babylon that they'll be mentioned on page 6. Me. 90% of everything you read about me in the press was made up. Every rag in England disseminates utter bullshit. Look, I say, as sweetly as possible. Before we start, do me a favor. Let's not talk about drugs this time. Montage of announcers' voices. The drug-addicted Tyler Perry gave us an interview the other night. The ex-drug-addicted rock star, the 60-year-old Tyler, the Jagger-esque Tyler, the just-divorced Tyler. It all has to be that or they wouldn't have their jobs. It's the oldest game in the book. But wait, why have I never been on the cover of Wonderland magazine? I'll dial my press agent. Evan Dando and Rachel Wood get themselves cover stories. I mean, darling, if they can make the cover of Wonderland, why can't I? So many choices. Should I suck cock or should I suck pussy? Dando or Evan Rachel Wood? I just don't know. Maybe I'll not suck cock and instead I'll write a song with Evan Dando and I'll just stick with Julianne Moore and Evan Rachel Wood as far as pussy goes. Yes. I mean, really, darling, if they can make the cover of Wonderland, is it worth my tongue on their ginies? Well, of course. Absolutely. Female fan. Hey, are you Steven Tyler? Me. I think so. Oh, fuck the book. You have no idea what movie this is. Get the picture? Steven Tyler, an aging but well-preserved rock star, moodily stares into space, wistfully looking out at his 12-room treehouse from the terrace of his eccentric compound in Marshfield, Massachusetts. He's talking into a digital tape recorder, which he barely knows how to operate. Steven Tyler, anxious but defiant. I know you're not going to have a lot of sympathy for what I'm about to tell you, but it's my fucking book and I can say what the hell I want, can I? Click. He shuts off the tape recorder and begins again. Steven Tyler continued. It's never again going to be the same way for me as it was before I was 25. Fuck. Is this just too self-indulgent? Click. But if I'm too self-deprecating, it's going to sound just like all those other fucking candy-ass autobiographies out there. He resumes dictating into the tape recorder. I sometimes have to put myself back in that headspace of when I was 22 just for my own sanity because it really sucks. I can't tell you why, but it doesn't feel good knowing that people already know all about me. They know my cat's name, my father's name, they know where I grew up. I'll be with people, and after a couple of hours of hanging out, they'll ask me out of the blue, "Oh, so do you still have that cat?" That's what it's like for me to be with a girl in a club. I never have to bring up my ex-wife or my last girlfriend. They know my story, and I'm as tired of it as they are. People like to tell stories. They'll tell me stories about myself. They'll tell me stories about Joe. Joe Perry, he's out of control, man. Yeah, I was with him the day he shot himself in the foot. Oh, yeah? You ask, Joe shot himself in the foot? When was that? And at the end of the story is that he almost shot himself in the foot. I go to people's houses who work for me, and the guy will take me aside and go, "Hey, tell the kids that I was your backstage guy, because that's what I told them." And I do it. Your dad, he was a guy. Without your dad, Aerosmith would have... I know all about this because I did it myself. Like when I told that story about Mick, that I was his brother. And imagine, I said we played with the Yardbirds too. This is when we all carried each other's equipment from the cars. We drove up to the stage at Staples High School in 1966 with a Chain Reaction. So now people do this stuff about me. Reading a poem from his notebook, Famous Stains, clears throat. You're born, then you die. Do you think that's what life gets? Then you're cheating yourself if the sun never sets. If truth is the truth and you make it your friend, then there'll always be a beginning, a middle, and an end. The truth that went on that some like to squash, of the dirt that went into what came out of the wash. Because Aerosmith, we're the dirt. We go through the ringer and we come out of the wash. My line used to be, I snorted half of Peru. Don't know where I got that from. Zircon-encrusted tweezers. That's gotta be Zappa. We all get little bits and pieces from the ether, so you gotta grab on to something and hold on to it. Because if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for the anything. And to me, Aerosmith always stood for something. In my book, it would be the three M's. Money, music, and, pussy. Did I just say that? I sleep with one eye open. I'm hyper-vigilant. I overfocus and I overanalyze things. I've always been that way. That's part of the insanity of being me. I'll walk along the sand and will not leave until I've turned over every stone on the beach. I'm obsessed to a fault. And so you couple that with being ADD and we're off. I'll start with A, D, C, then I jump to Z. In fact, it's the E to the Z, U, twiddle D. Thank you, Richie Supa. Oh, and by the way, 'twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gamble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Oh, and by the way, that was 60 minutes ago. What was that again? What do you mean, what do I mean? If I quit Aerosmith tomorrow, I'll just go paddle my own canoe. I love canoeing so much that I brought mine to Maui and married it. It's the only place they let you marry an inanimate object as long as you do the sacred Kiawe dance. Stephen's Secrets of Life, number 9. Get naked. I'll tell you, this year, Aaron and I got back from a ride from Sturgis one night, took a shower, and walked naked out in the backyard as it was 92 degrees while smoking a cigarette. I said, oh my God, this must be what it's like in paradise, to be walking around naked outside this house, as Donovan must have imagined when he wrote, Wear Your Love Like Heaven. He just called me to say hi. Adam and Eve, man, they knew. Most of what happens in life is based on electromagnetism. Each of us generates a specific type of electricity, our own frequency. We each have a unique aura, and auras are connected to each other by the electromagnetism that comes out of your personality. If you're a sex addict, and you walk into a room full of people without saying a word to them, you can make contact. They know who you are. They smell you, as my friend Ray Tabano would say. Energy is an almost psychic property. I remember Mouse McElroy and his girlfriend when we lived in the old gray clabbered house in Sunapee. Mouse was a keyboard player, and right out of the blue, he would go into seizures. Grand mals. And right before this guy would go out, you could feel it 30 seconds before. He'd be still looking around the room, but you'd feel this surge of energy emitting from him like silent lightning. I'm what, 63 now. I've been to Maine, Spain, Spokane, seen goats fuck in the marketplace, but it's taken me 60 years to realize I don't know anything. I've come to find that out after going around and through all this. I really don't know what the hell it's all about. And I like that. Wait, stop. I'm not finished. Are you crazy? This isn't the end of the book. I have more to say, you fucks. Turn the fucking page. Chapter 15. To Zanzibar and Back. The man said, "Why do you think you're here?" I said, "I got no idea." Amy Winehouse, Rehab. The press are always there, like jackals, hanging around at the gates as the latest celebrity drug addict drags his sorry ass into a waiting limo. When I came out of the chit-chat rehab in Wernersville, Pennsylvania in 1989, it was for the last time, I'd hoped. The press asked, with their fake sympathy, "So, how was it, Steve, getting through all that? The 30 days? Or the 40 years it took me to get here?" I think 30 days is a small price to pay for the rest of my life. "If it helped you find your soul again," I said, "then how can you not owe it your life?" And then I began to explain, in the way the recovering addict is expected to do, with a required contrition and shame. And then you give them the promised fairy tale ending, renewed faith in life after the nightmare of addiction and willful self-destruction. All true, I wasn't just mouthing pieties about my road to recovery. But there was something I wasn't saying, not because I was hiding anything, but just because it was so weird and intimate and ultimately unexplainable. Some of it I missed, some of it I got. The fairy tale links I understood. As a child, I lived in the woods, and I saw where the sap to make maple syrup came from. And later on, I sought it out. I went and got some heroin because I wanted to feel what it was like not just to taste the sap from the tree, but to feel it coursing through my veins. Opium from Mother Earth. The resin of the poppy plant. The gooey nectar of the earth. Roots, tendrils growing out of the damp, humid soil. Unconsciously, I connected the pine trees, the unearthly silence of the woods I had played in, with the opium I numbed myself with, as if the two linked a secret passage back to my childhood. But my romance with opium and heroin and drugs of all kinds was over, or so I thought. Though I lived on the tail of a comet, and though I came from a town called Euphoria. In 2007, I left my home for a world tour. Everything was fine, I was feeling no pain. Why? After 12 years of being straight, I'd started using painkillers again because I was in terrible pain from my feet. On May 31st, 2007, we played to 40,000 people at the Dubai Exiles Rugby Club Stadium in Dubai. It was so hot there we couldn't play until 11 o'clock at night when the temperature had gone down to 80, 85 degrees. I greeted the crowd in Arabic. Okay, one word. Marhaba. Welcome. But still. The day of the concert, Aaron and I went out into the desert with sand dune explorers, camelback tour rides. We rented 5 trucks and took along a bunch of people from the hotel, security, and a truckload full of camera gear and stuff for a photo shoot. The SUVs were flying up and down the dunes, some 30 feet high, like we were surfing great sand waves. They have to let the air out of the tires to get traction on the sand. We drove for 20 minutes into the great unknown of sand and sand and more sand. It was 110 degrees out there. If I'd been left out there, I wouldn't know where in hell I was. It's just a sea of sand, like being in the middle of the ocean. Sandstorms in the desert come up out of nowhere and hit so fast, there's tsunamis of sand. And when that happens, you're not only lost, you're blinded. A group of Bedouins was crossing the dunes on camels. I was curious about how they found their way around out there, so we drove over to talk to them. Some of these camels cost more than a Lamborghini. One of the Bedouins told me that the camel he was riding on was a dromedary of a very high strain and worth $200,000. There are racing camels worth over $1 million. I asked him, "How do you know where you're going out here with no landmarks, no signs?" And he goes, "Well, the camels know. If you're lost, the camel will take you back." Ah, no wonder the price. I'd pay it, too. It's fucking life-threatening out there. And not only do camels have their own GPS sensors, they also invented butter. Yeah, they did. When the Bedouins carried milk across the desert in goatskin bags, they found that it had turned into a solid, butter, when they got to the other side. But I prefer the account of the invention of butter in Little Black Sambo, a book my mother read to me. It wasn't as politically incorrect when I was growing up